Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Francis Alonso reporting. Congo's Republic's government has announced Tuesday that it would hold a referendum this month on constitutional change in a move that would allow veteran President Denis Sassou Nguesso to extend his decades-long rule. The 71-year-old former military commander has ruled Congo Republic for all but 5 years since 1979. He has won previous terms and disputed elections in 2002 and 2009. While Sassou Nguesso has not officially declared his candidacy for the June 2016 presidential election, he is widely expected to seek a third term. The Constitution of 2002 limits the number of terms to two and excludes candidates over 70. South Africa's foreign minister has gone on the offensive against the International Criminal Court over a nation's failure to arrest Sudan's president in June. The ICC gave South Africa until October 5th to explain its actions. South Africa's foreign minister has asked the International Criminal Court for more time to explain her government's decision to not arrest Sudan's president despite a domestic court order that sought to prevent him from leaving the country. South African officials say Sudan's president Omar Bashir enjoyed diplomatic immunity as a delegate to the African Union summit in Johannesburg. Paralympian star Oscar Pistorius will have to undergo psychotherapy, according to South Africa's Parole Review Board Tuesday, after blocking his release from prison just 10 months into his 5-year sentence for killing his girlfriend. The review panel decided on Monday that an earlier decision by the parole board to allow the 28-year-old athlete out on house arrest was premature and referred the case back for reconsideration. This is VOA News. The United Nations Children's Fund is urging Sudan's warring parties to give the go-ahead for a life-saving measles vaccination campaign. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
UNICEF welcomes a recent ceasefire agreement between Sudan's government and rebels in three parts of the country. The agency says it hopes the cessation of hostilities will finally allow it and other aid organizations access to tens of thousands of children in the Nuba Mountains, parts of the Blue Nile states, and Jabal Mara in northern Darfur. UNICEF spokesman Christophe Bouillirac says these areas have been off limits for 4 years. He says his agency is extremely worried about the condition of children there, as a full picture of their humanitarian needs is not known. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Russian Defense Ministry Tuesday angrily dismissed reports that its planes had launched airstrikes against the Syrian city of Palmyra as false, according to the TASS news agency. All reports by foreign media that Russian planes had allegedly struck the city are an absolute lie. That's according to Major General Igor Kononeshkov, a spokesman for the ministry. Our planes did not strike populated areas. Syrian state television and a monitoring group said earlier Tuesday that Russian jets had hit Islamic targets in the city. NATO Secretary General, meanwhile, has rejected Moscow's claim that its military incursion into alliance airspace over Turkey wasn't intentional or important. Jens Stoltenberg, the NATO chief, spoke to a news conference in Brussels Tuesday and says those reported incidents were serious.
Russia's deployment of significant forces in Syria is of great concern. Russian combat aircraft have violated Turkish airspace. This is unacceptable.
Meanwhile, Turkey's president Tuesday questioned the future of relations between Ankara and Moscow after those multiple reports of airspace violations. Some steps that we do not desire are being taken. It is not suitable for Turkey to accept them. That's according to Recep Tayyip Erdogan during a news conference with Belgium's prime minister in Brussels, according to Turkey's Hurriyet Daily News. The top U.S. general in Afghanistan, John Campbell, went before a United States Senate hearing today. The hearing was scheduled before the U.S. strike on a Doctors Without Borders hospital in Kunduz that killed 22 people. General Campbell has ordered an investigation into the incident and says preliminary results should be available in the next couple of days. FIFA presidential contender Chung Myung-jun is facing a 19-year suspension that he says is by the Ethics Committee alleged violations in support of Korea's failed bid for the World Cup. I'm Francis Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Ruhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The United Nations Children's Fund is urging Sudan's warring parties to give the go-ahead for a life-saving measles vaccination campaign. Thousands of children in hard-to-reach areas are currently at risk for the disease.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details coming up.
Also, the European Union has presented Turkey with a draft action plan to help stem the flow of migrants. 11 Chadian soldiers have been killed in a pre-dawn attack by Boko Haram fighters near the Nigerian border. And Human Rights Watch criticizes the outcome of a trial against soldiers accused of mass rape in the DRC.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Somalia, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Top story this hour, the European Union has presented Turkey with a draft action plan to help stem the flow of migrants and refugees. Reuters reports the EU would provide funding to Turkey to help shelter the more than 2 million migrants and refugees within its borders. The plan would provide up to about $1 billion and give some refugees a chance to settle in Europe. Turkish citizens could also get easier visa terms for traveling in Europe. Under the plan, Turkey would increase its Coast Guard patrols and cooperate with the Greek Navy. It would also tighten border security with Greece and Bulgaria. Turkey would also have to take back so-called irregular refugees who do not qualify for asylum. European Commission Chief Jean-Claude Juncker says the EU and Turkey must work together to develop an asylum policy. The migrants and refugees in Turkey enter Europe through the Greek islands. Turkey has warned that 3 million more refugees could flee fighting in Syria.
Also, European interior ministers are scheduled to meet Thursday in Luxembourg to discuss the crisis. Prior to that meeting, the interior ministers of the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary and Romania will hold their own meeting. All are opposed to mandatory refugee quotas, but were outvoted by other European nations. The AP quotes Hungary's foreign minister as saying his country will step up opposition to relocating 120,000 migrants and refugees. Meanwhile, more than 1,800 migrants and refugees rescued off the coast of Libya yesterday are being brought to Italy today. The Associated Press says Italian and other European vessels found them trying to cross the Mediterranean on four wooden ships and two rubber dinghies.
Eleven Chadian soldiers have been killed in a pre-dawn attack by Boko Haram fighters near the Nigerian border. A military spokesman says 17 Boko Haram fighters died in the fight. The Nigeria-based insurgents have killed thousands and displaced more than a million civilians in northeast Nigeria. In the past year, Boko Haram has broadened its campaign into Chad and other nations bordering Nigeria. Chad has joined a regional military force of 8,700 to combat Boko Haram.
The United Nations Children's Fund is urging Sudan's warring parties to give the go-ahead for a life-saving measles vaccination campaign. Thousands of children in hard-to-reach areas are currently at risk for the disease. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
UNICEF welcomes a recent ceasefire agreement between Sudan's government and rebels in three parts of the country. The agency says it hopes the cessation of hostilities will finally allow it and other aid organizations access to tens of thousands of children in the Nuba Mountains, parts of the Blue Nile states, and Jabal Mara in northern Darfur. UNICEF spokesman Christophe Bouyrak says these areas have been off limits for 4 years. He says his agency is extremely worried about the condition of children there, as a full picture of their humanitarian needs is not known.
An estimated 165,000 children under the age of five have had no access to vaccination in the Nuba Mountains and in some localities in the Blue Nile State alone. Sudan's children continue to be beleaguered by disease outbreaks such as measles. As you know, measles is killing lots of children when it's not prevented, dengue fever and diarrhea.
Sudan was hit with a measles outbreak in January. Since then, there have been outbreaks of this killer disease in all 18 states, with 14 states at epidemic level. UNICEF reports 3,161 cases were confirmed by August. This is more than four times the normal annual caseload in Sudan. Bouyourak says measles vaccination campaigns have been ongoing for the past few months throughout the country, except for the three inaccessible areas. If the ceasefire agreement holds, he says this would provide an opportunity to rectify this dangerous situation. He notes children in Sudan continue to be victims of conflict and chronic underdevelopment. He says some 2 million children under age 5 are acutely malnourished every year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehis Ruhib, 12 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The European Union has presented Turkey with a draft action plan to help stem the flow of migrants and refugees. 11 Chadian soldiers have been killed in a pre-dawn attack by Boko Haram fighters near the Nigerian border. And the United Nations Children's Fund is urging Sudan's warring parties to give the go-ahead for a life-saving measles vaccination campaign. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Human Rights Watch says the conviction of just two rank-and-file DRC soldiers out of a total of 39 tried for a mass rape at Minova in 2012 is a failure of justice. The rights group says despite enormous amounts of funding, the system is failing to deliver justice to victims and those accused of international crimes. Nick Long reports from Goma.
It's been widely reported that at least 76 women and girls were raped at Minova in the eastern DRC after a chaotic army retreat in November 2012. In May 2014, a military court convicted two rank-and-file soldiers of rape and 25 of looting. They were sentenced to jail terms of up to 20 years with no right of appeal. But all the officers on trial were acquitted and no high-level commander was charged. In a report released this week on the case, Human Rights Watch says the only evidence against most of the accused men was that they had been absent from roll calls. The report's author is Geraldine Mattioli-Zeltner.
Of the 25 who were eventually convicted, only two were identified by victims during the trial.
Mattioli-Zeltner said the women had been attacked at night, making identification more difficult. More effort should have been made to hold commanders responsible, she says. Human Rights Watch says the case was rushed to trial, largely due to international pressure and defendants had weak legal representation. The military court ordered the state to pay reparations to victims, but they have not been paid, nor have reparations in about 30 other war crimes cases in the DRC, according to Human Rights Watch. The government declined to comment. The international community has poured what Mattioli-Zeltner calls enormous amounts of money into the DRC justice sector in the past 10 years. There have been improvements, she says, but too much money goes on repetitive training, while certain attitudes remain unchanged.
I think you could continue international assistance like it's been going now for another 10 years, and then you probably have the same kind of trials in 10 years.
A report by the Open Society Initiative in 2013 found donors had spent about $150 million on Congolese justice over a period of several years, while the government was officially budgeting in the low tens of millions for the sector each year, most of it not spent. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma, DRC.
So South Africa's foreign minister has gone on the offensive against the International Criminal Court over her nation's failure to arrest Sudan's president in June. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg. The ICC gave South Africa until October 5th to explain its actions.
South Africa's foreign minister has asked the International Criminal Court for more time to explain her government's decision to not arrest Sudan's president, despite a domestic court order that sought to prevent him from leaving the country. Minister Maite Nkuana-Mashabane also threw a few jabs at the International Court, adding fuel to tensions between the court and many of its African member states. All nine of the situations the court is investigating are in Africa.
South Africa was unfortunately not afforded the opportunity to present legal arguments on this application. And hence, it is of the view that the principles of justice were not adhered to. In view of the above, South Africa is of the view that a serious infringement of South Africa's rights as a state party has taken place and that the court has acted against the letter and spirit of the Rome Statute.
South African officials say Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir enjoyed diplomatic immunity as a delegate to the African Union Summit in Johannesburg. But international criminal justice lawyer Angela Mutukudi of the Southern African Litigation Center says South Africa set a poor example.
Well, our position obviously is that South Africa had a duty to arrest President Omar al-Bashir when he was here, and that failure to comply with that duty has been ruled unconstitutional and invalid, and we support that judgment, and that South Africa had obligations that it had to adhere to, and it failed to do so.
Kenya and Congo, which are members of the court, have also allowed Bashir to visit without arrest. Bashir spent no more than 48 hours in Johannesburg during the summit and gave no speeches while avoiding the media. But that trip was the closest he has come to being arrested since he was charged by the ICC in 2009 over the long-running conflict in Darfur, where the United Nations estimates some 300,000 people have been killed and more than 2 million have been displaced. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
A diagnosis of breast cancer does not mean the end of a working woman's career, but balancing treatment while working does have its challenges. Well, this is one woman's experience as we mark Breast Cancer Awareness Month in October.
In 2012, 42-year-old Tara Cernasek was a career woman working as an executive assistant for a nonprofit in New York City. When 2 months into her new job, she discovered a lump in her left breast. After going to the doctor and undergoing numerous tests, she was diagnosed with stage 2B breast cancer. She was told the treatment plan would be surgery, which involved a lumpectomy, radiation, and 18 months total of chemotherapy.
I was very afraid because I was new at my job. They really didn't know what I was capable of doing yet. I hadn't proven myself yet. And now here I was presenting this big problem to them.
Cernasek said she was able to manage her work schedule pretty well without missing a lot of time from work.
I used a couple of vacation days, one sick day for the day of the diagnosis, then a couple of vacation days for the surgery, and the hospital worked with me on the chemo to do it early mornings or late evenings and Saturdays. So I didn't miss that much time. I did use all 12 of my sick days, but I didn't go over any allotted time.
While Cernasek continued to work throughout her treatments, there were times when she said it was hard, physically and mentally.
There were some days that were worse than others. I was very tired sometimes. And also one of the side effects of the chemo was chemo brain. I got a little foggier and I needed everybody to slow down to talk slower so I could write everything down because I would forget a lot of things. So that was challenging, but I was able to manage that fortunately because the staff was very supportive.
Cernasek had the help and assistance of her coworkers, who all pitched in to help her complete projects and assignments, while management was not always able to be as flexible.
My actual supervisor was a little trickier to deal with. She would get very frustrated about coming in late and staying late or making up the time because really she needed me there at certain times. And there were some days I couldn't be there in the morning because I would have a radiation treatment in the morning, for example. So I did get a little bit of stress from her.
During the course of her treatments, Cernusek received bad news concerning her job.
I was laid off in April of 2013, so I still had 4 months of chemo to go. That was extremely stressful because I didn't even feel I could interview for other jobs and request this, and also I didn't have my hair back. I didn't look that well, so I stopped interviewing and did some temp work. It was very frustrating, but I don't think I was terminated because of cancer necessarily. I think that that might have been one of the deciding factors, but there were so many people laid off during this restructure that I couldn't say it was me only.
Cernusek persevered through her treatments while searching for another job that was right for her. Her tenacity paid off. She found another job working in her field of expertise as an executive assistant for a nonprofit.
I just started here in August of this year. It was a really long time, 2 years of searching, taking temp work here and there, a brief stint with a real estate company, which was just to help make ends meet. So it was a very long search, but I'm really happy to be here now, and I'm hoping that this works out and this is for the long term.
Cernusek said she found support through the nonprofit Cancer and Careers. She said they not only offered her personal support, but also professional support, such as how to talk to her employer and her doctors about her disease and to stress the importance of the need to keep working.
I didn't do that at first. I learned that from Cancer and Careers, and the doctors did leave out a lot of what I should expect from my work. Like, they never mentioned chemo brain. They never mentioned peripheral neuropathy, which would take the feeling from my fingers and toes and affect my balance.
Cernusek says that working while undergoing treatment for cancer not only helped sustain her financially, working also helped her to feel normal and productive rather than being focused on being sick. In addition, she advises women to just be honest with themselves and with their employers about what they can and can't continue to do. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
Malawi has instituted new visa fees that tourism operators say are another blow to the country's already struggling tourism industry. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Malawi introduced the $75 visa fee from October 1st in a bid to boost government revenue. The new measure applies to citizens of all countries that require Malawians to pay visa fees. Jean Kalilan is the Minister of Home Affairs and Internal Security.
But also there is a security matter in it. You cannot just have people just entering anyhow. There must be control in the entry points into the country. And one of them is this one that is being introduced.
Authorities held a carnival Saturday to showcase the country's tourism attractions, including traditional music and dance. Destinations include national parks, game reserves, mountains and Lake Malawi, Africa's third largest freshwater lake. But Malawi has been struggling to woo foreign travelers. A recent World Economic Forum report on travel and tourism cites Malawi's air transport sector as among the worst in the world. The report also says that in 2013, Malawi earned about $34,000 from international tourists. Neighboring Zambia earned $155,000 and Zimbabwe $851,000. Rose Biusata Sambo is the executive director for Malawi Tourism Council. She says the new visa fee won't help matters.
When you've got Zambia and Zimbabwe doing a uni visa, $25 in each country, and then you've got Tanzania at $30, and then you've got Malawi at $75, we're not being competitive.
She says Malawi is not yet a standalone destination. Free entry drew visitors already in the neighboring countries.
People usually come to Malawi and Zambia. So when you're looking at the visa fee cost alone, that's a big detriment as well to tourism growth.
But government tourism authorities say they are working to promote domestic tourism. On the international level, the Department of Tourism says it has boosted advertising and publicity, citing recent features in major travel magazines like National Geographic and South African Airways in-flight magazine, Sawubona. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Coming up on 25 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Amnesty International has urged President Alassane Ouattara to end a wave of arbitrary arrest of opposition supporters as the October 25th presidential election approaches. Amnesty researchers Francois Patouel says more than 60 members of the National Coalition for Change opposition bloc have been arrested as they protest a decision by the Constitutional Court that validated Ouattara's candidacy. 30 demonstrators are still in police custody. Mr. Ouattara faces a fractured opposition and is heavily favored to win a second five-year term. Ivorians will vote this month in the first presidential vote since a post-election civil war that took the lives of more than 3,000 people in 2011.
In Ghana, Vice President Kwesi Bikoi Amisa Arthur has suspended 7 of the country's 12 high court judges who were accused of bribery and corruption. The action to suspend the 7 high court judges and another 22 judges in lower courts follows the public screening last month of a documentary film by a local investigative journalist. The film shows judges demanding sexual favors, receiving bribes to dismiss cases, and extorting money. The journalist Anas Ari Miao Anas says he has about 500 hours of videotape evidence. Ghana's Judicial Council recommended the suspensions.
Progress in good governance across Africa is stalling, according to the latest figures compiled by the Mo Ibrahim Foundation. At the same time, a few countries are showing notable improvement. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
The Ibrahim Index says that it holds the most comprehensive collection of data on African governance. Each year, analysts measure each country on aspects such as its business environment, accountability of public figures, and legislation on violence against women. At the launch of the latest annual report, founder Mo Ibrahim said the overall trend in the past 4 years raises concerns.
We notice that this upward direction somehow plateaued. It hasn't gone back. It's still going up at a very slow pace. So the first thing we say here is African governance improvement is stalling.
21 countries have seen their overall governance scores fall since 2011, but the trend masks significant progress in some areas. Health and education have improved across the continent. Ibrahim says Ivory Coast, which is to hold elections later this month, showed the biggest overall improvement.
Cote d'Ivoire have done well in every aspect of governance. But again, you have to remember Cote d'Ivoire is coming out of conflict. But then you have some countries which is not coming out of conflicts. You have like Rwanda, Morocco, Togo, Kenya. These countries really have governments which are really focusing in development and delivering.
Ongoing conflicts in Somalia, South Sudan and Central African Republic meant they came at the bottom of the list. The measures of economic governance show some of the biggest declines. Analysts say several African states have suffered because of falling commodity prices in recent years. Conversely, successful countries have diversified economies, says former president of the African Development Bank, Donald Kabaruka, speaking at the launch event in London.
The commonalities, they're not dependent on commodities. So there have been something else happening, which has been A, increased investments, number two, increased domestic consumption, and number three, underrated growth in regional trade.
The Ibrahim Foundation says the aim of the index is to remove the mystery around governance and empower the ordinary African citizen to hold those in power to account. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou.
Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The European Union has presented Turkey with a draft action plan to help stem the flow of migrants and refugees. 11 Chadian soldiers have been killed in a pre-dawn attack by Boko Haram fighters. And the United Nations Children's Fund urges Sudan's warring parties to give the go-ahead for a life-saving measles vaccination campaign. Coming up, music from Somalia. And in our feature segment, organizing awareness campaigns to change the attitude of rural communities in Africa against child marriage. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are kicking off with African football.
Kim, Africa's qualifying campaign for the 2018 World Cup football tournament in Russia officially kicks off Wednesday with four first-round matches. South Sudan will host Mauritania in Juba. Seychelles is at home against Burundi. Mauritius will play visiting Kenya, and Tanzania will host Malawi. The games are part of a busy first round of 2018 World Cup qualifying in Africa, as we hear now from the VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman, Shagun Dot on the spot at Ayemi.
Good evening, Africa. 26 countries will play over two legs in the first round. The 13 aggregate winners will advance to the second round, where they will join 27 other teams for another round of home and away matches. The 20 aggregate winners will advance to the third and final round. In that round, the 20 teams will be divided into five groups of four teams each. After playing home and away round-robin matches, the winners of each group will qualify to represent Africa at the 2018 FIFA World Cup.
Thanks, Shagun. That's Shagun Dot on the spot at Adeyemi, reporting from Lagos, Nigeria. South Sudan will be playing its first ever World Cup qualifying match when it plays Mauritania Wednesday in Juba. South Sudan's captain, Richard Justin Lado, is sounding very confident ahead of the game. He says, and I quote, "We are ready, totally ready. We know what we have to do, and we can spring a surprise." Our coach, Sung Ji Lee, has created a style of play that's based on defensive discipline and counterattacking football, and I think we can cause some damage. We need to win for many reasons, and we will win. And in case our VOA football fans are wondering about South Sudan's head coach, Sung Ji Lee, well, he's a South Korean who was appointed last year. And last month, the South Korean coach led the South Sudanese to the biggest victory in their young footballing history, a 1-0 victory over Equatorial Guinea in Juba in a 2017 Africa Cup of Nations qualifier. Meanwhile, the head coach of Seychelles, Ralph Jean-Louis, is hoping his team, nicknamed the Pirates, can make a breakthrough against Burundi. In the coach's words, and I quote once again, "We want to win our first match. We want to show the Seychelles people that we can do it, and I have the players that can beat Burundi." Now, this first round of 2018 World Cup qualifying in Africa features the lower-ranked teams on the continent. World Football's governing body, FIFA, released its latest set of monthly rankings on October 1st. Of the eight African teams in action Wednesday, Mauritania has the highest ranking, 23rd in Africa and 89th overall, And Mauritius has the lowest ranking, according to FIFA, 47th in Africa and 168th overall.
Friends, we can all listen to the sunny side of sports.
Yes, my friend.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
Voice of America.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Now let's go to England for an update on the Rugby World Cup. The two-time world champion Springboks of South Africa will be big favorites when they play the United States Wednesday at Olympic Stadium in London. The South Africans, after a surprising loss to Japan in their opening match, have scored convincing victories over Samoa and Scotland. The USA, meanwhile, sits at the bottom of Pool B with no points after losses to Samoa and Scotland. The South Africans lead the pool with 11 points, and they're looking to advance to the quarterfinals with a big victory over the USA. Speaking in London, Springboks head coach Heineke Meyer says his team can't be too overconfident.
We do have respect for America or the USA. We've learned as well. There's no easy games here. So it's going to be a big call for these guys because it's a three-day turnaround or 4 days, depends how you see it. And so it's going to be strained on their bodies, but it's the same for most of the teams. And hopefully they won't tire, but it's tough on them because the previous two games was also very, very tough. So I just thought we have to set a standard, but we have to play to our strengths, keep our feet on the ground and build the innings.
Coach Meyer has decided to move Brian Habana over to the right wing for the match against the USA. For his part, Habana says the Springboks are looking for steady improvement after the shock failure against Japan.
The last 2 weeks have been good, but all our focus and energy this week is improving against America come 4:45 on Wednesday afternoon. You know, they're a team that they might not be ranked in the top 10 in the world, but we've seen in the two games they've played already, their physicality, intensity, and the way they approach the game is something that doesn't make it easy to play against. So we know it's going to be a tough test waiting for us, and as a group, we will always be happy with where we are. You know, we've got big goals and dreams for this team, and again, Wednesday's another hurdle that, you know, we can't afford to slip up in. So, yeah, it's been good, but still not quite where we want to be.
The 32-year-old Habana has 12 tries during his Rugby World Cup career. That puts him three behind the record held by the now-retired Jonah Lomu of New Zealand. Habana says he's interested in winning matches with the Springboks and allowing records to take care of themselves.
I think it really is important. You know, obviously, it would be fantastic to score tries, and you know, I know the record's three away. But for me, at the moment, it's about literally what is the next job, you know, for the next phase of play, and whether that be running 6 or 7 kilometres a game or scoring tries. For me, that's probably the most important: the contribution that you make on a positive aspect to the success of the team.
That's South African rugby player Brian Habana speaking in London, where the Springboks will play the United States on Wednesday. Meanwhile, South Africa's neighbor Namibia will also be back in action Wednesday when they play Georgia in Exeter, England. The Namibians, like the Americans, are at the bottom of their pool with no points from two matches.
Oh, Africa. Africa, world, worldwide.
is Africa. Tamina, mina, eh, eh. Waka, waka, eh, eh. Tamina, mina, sangalewa. This time for Africa.
I'm very, 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 very excited. Nichabulile.
Hola. Cause this is Africa. Tamina, mina, eh, eh. Waka, waka, eh, eh. Tamina, mina, sangalewa. This time for Africa.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
And when you visit VOAnews.com, make sure you check out the Sunny Side of Sports blog, in which I write about a variety of sporty topics. The address is blogs.voanews.com/sunny. Once again, that address, blogs.voanews.com/sunny. My latest blog post is titled Didier Drogba Making an Impact in MLS. And I write about the Ivorian football star's inaugural season in Major League Soccer. You might say Drogba has had sudden impact with the Canada-based Montreal Impact Club. Drogba has scored 7 goals in his first 6 matches for Montreal. Magnus Chisholm Onwuadiwe, the humble apostle of the sunny side of sports, read my blog post in Owerri, Nigeria. And the humble apostle had this to say: "Hello, Mr. Sonny. That was a befitting piece on the African football legend Didier Drogba. It has been an exciting and rewarding career for the gifted Ivorian. Looking at his age and his accomplishments in football, one can clearly see that the 37-year-old Drogba is not yet done in football. I like the excitement he has brought to MLS, and I see him scoring more goals in the weeks and months ahead." And speaking of Africans scoring goals in MLS, let's give a Sunny Side of Sports shout-out for Kai Kamara of the Columbus Crew, the 31-year-old striker from Sierra Leone. He's having his best-ever season in MLS. Kamara leads the league with 22 goals in 31 matches played. That doubles his previous MLS high of 11 goals in 2012 when he played for Sporting Kansas City. 2 Nigerian strikers, Obafemi Martins of the Seattle Sounders and Fanendo Addy of the Portland Timbers, are also among the top 10 scorers in Major League Soccer. Martins has 14 goals in 19 matches for the Sounders, while Addy has found the net 12 times in 30 appearances for the Timbers. The Africans making an impact, sudden impact, in Major League Soccer. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, police in South Africa cracking down on motorists who drive while drunk. And next, organizing awareness campaigns to change the attitude of rural communities in Africa against child marriage. But first, some music. Here is Kanan of Somalia with Fatima.
Taste and devour. We rise early, pace up the hour. Streets is bustling, hustling, they harder. You can't have the sweet with no sour. Spices, herbs, sweet scent of flower. She came out precisely the hour. Clouds disappear, the sun shows the power. No chance of a probable shower. I fell in love with my neighbor's daughter. I wanted to protect and support her. Never mind, I'm just 12 and a quarter. I had dreams beyond our border. Is it true? They say all you need is just love. Is it true? What about those who have loved? Only to find that it's taken away. And why do they say that the children have rights to be free? To be free. What about those who have known? Whose memory
The lessons I ask God to slow down the seconds, he does the opposite. That's what I'm guessing. I better chill and count my own blessings. Fatima, Fatima, what is the matter? How come you ain't come up the ladder so we can be like there's no tomorrow? Then you gon' make me wait till tomorrow. She spoke Arabic and Swahili. She say upendo unto habibi. You so bright, you shine like my TV. Then one day she never came to meet me.
Is it true when they say all you need is just love? Is it true? What about those who have love? Only to find that it's taken away. And why do they say that the children have rights to be free? To be free. What about those who I know? Whose memory still lives inside of me? Fatima, what did the young man say before he stole you away? On that fateful day, Fatima.
Beholder, how come everyone hushed when she walked by? How come girls would look just to scold her? How come the angel wanted to hold her?
Fatima, Fatima,
I'm in America. I make rhymes and I make umbilicate. You would've liked the parks in Connecticut. You would've said I'm working too hard again. Damn you, shooter, damn you, the building. Whose walls hid the blood she was spilling? Damn you, country, so good at killing. Damn you, feeling for persevering.
Is it true? Taken away, and why do they say that the children have rights to be free? To be free. What about those who I've known? Whose memory still lives inside of me? Fatima, what did the gunman say before he took you away on that fateful day? Fatima, Fatima, did he know your name or the plans we made to go to New York City? Fatima.
Shed a tear, 'cause this here, it's a celebration. We're not mourning, we're celebrating. Yeah, so baby don't cry.
Kanan of Somalia with Fatima.
Well, police in South Africa are cracking down on motorists who drive while drunk. As road deaths climb, the government is also debating harsher penalties for drunk drivers. Meanwhile, members of the public are accusing the police of extorting bribes from them and assaulting them for allegedly driving under the influence of alcohol. Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg.
My name is Blessing and I'm from Scooter Angels. And I'm your driver today.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
A woman hands her car keys to a designated driver outside a Johannesburg bar. She called the Scooter Angels to get her home safely after drinking more wine than expected. Owner Jeremy De Hoeder says there's been a big spike in demand recently.
The traffic department enforcing the no drinking and driving laws
the more roadblocks, you know, they're clamping down, becoming more stringent, and that's obviously good for business.
De Goede says people in South Africa are more aware of the dangers of drunk driving. But he adds, many of his Johannesburg clients also say they want to avoid being hassled by Metro Police. Motorists say the police demand bribes and threaten to jail them. A young woman stands at a busy intersection. She was recently involved in a minor collision with another vehicle. Soon after that, she says, a Metro Police vehicle arrived.
And the next thing, another one arrived. And another one, and another one. In the end, there were probably about 12 Metro cars with about 24 officers on the scene. Things turned very ugly, very fast.
She asked VOA to disguise her voice. She says the officers swore at her and screamed that she was drunk. A breathalyzer test showed she wasn't above the legal blood alcohol limit. Then the woman says they surrounded her and pushed her.
Eventually, I had a panic attack. They just kept making me blow in the breathalyzer as if they weren't happy with the result that their machine was giving them. And all the while, they have their hands on their firearms.
The Metro Police say they take all allegations made against officers seriously and will investigate them if reported. Darren Taylor for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Thousands of underage girls in the Horn of Africa are forced to marry. Ethiopia's northern province of Gondar has the highest rate. 44% of girls there will find themselves married before turning 18. Martha Vander Wolf reports from Gondar, where the local government and UNICEF are organizing awareness campaigns to change the attitude of rural communities.
60-year-old Hibis Ababayu from the town of Gondar was about to be married to a 28-year-old man when she was just 13. Last year, her parents again tried to marry her to another man. Hibis says her parents did not even tell her about the marriage, but her friends had overheard the arrangements and informed her. She says that immediately when she heard, she reported it to the school principal and to the lead teacher of the girls' club. They spoke to the police. After they negotiated with her parents, they managed to cancel the marriage arrangements. The girls' club Hibis joined in school is a place where information is provided to girls about child marriage through awareness interventions. Especially for rural communities, child marriage is the social norm. The local government says that raising awareness and changing the attitude of the community is the biggest challenge. The police, religious leaders, and development partners such as United Nations Children's Fund are involved in trying to change the mindset about child marriage and eliminate all forms of child marriage by 2025. UNICEF program worker Zemzem Shakur says child marriage has several consequences for the girl's life.
The first one is easily they are forced to drop out from school, which shapes their destiny to be a housewife or to be in a very different or vulnerable situation. The other one is the health consequence, because they don't get treatment easily, and they may not also have information where to get services.
One in five girls in Ethiopia are married before the age of 18. In Gondar, a northern region, almost half the underage girls are married, even though the legal age is set at 18. Hibis feels lucky to have been rescued. She says many of her friends are already married. She says the thinking in the community is to marry off children at a very early age, since they do not see why girls should get an education or how they can become somebody. One of the awareness campaigns in Gondar is an afternoon of musical performances on the main square. The event attracts large crowds, and the message appears to come across to the audience of mostly boys. They say they agree girls should not get married before the age of 18. Solomon Asefa is one of them. He says girls first need to be physically ready to get married. Then they have to be educated so that they can be what they want to be. Hibis is now in 8th grade school. She hopes her parents will allow her to attend university if she keeps receiving good grades. 40-year-old Abeba Ayele was less fortunate. She lives in a village an hour outside Gondor. She was forced into a marriage last year and now has a six-month-old baby. Abeba says it is difficult to deal with the new attitude from her peers. She says everyone was gossiping about her when she was pregnant and it gave her psychological problems. Abeba has registered for school again but is not sure if she can attend as she does not have the funds to look after herself and her baby. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Gondor.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is donating $15.7 million worth of food commodities to Malawi to assist a portion of the 2.8 million people in need of humanitarian food assistance. U.S. Ambassador to Malawi, Virginia Palmer, made the announcement in late September. This assistance is in response to the government of Malawi's September 21st appeal for donor support, following the Vulnerability Assessment Committee findings in July 2015. As a result of the unfavorable 2014-2015 farming season, 2.8 million Malawians in 24 districts will require food assistance from October 2015 to March 2016. The late onset of rains, severe flooding, mid-season dry spells, and early ending of rains contributed to the approximately 30% reduction in Malawi's maize crop. The UN Food Program will receive and distribute the United States food donation of 6,250 metric tons of beans and 2,810 metric tons of vitamin A and D fortified vegetable oil as part of a larger food basket designed to meet the nutritional requirements of those in need. The food donation will arrive in Malawi beginning in October 2015. Since 2012, the United States, through the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, has provided over $55 million worth of food assistance to address food insecurity stemming from recurrent adverse weather in Malawi. In August 2014, the United States provided $7 million through the World Food Program to support the MVAC response to the seasonal food insecurity that affected 640,000 people in 19 districts across Malawi. Earlier this year, the United States provided further assistance, totaling $9.3 million, to Malawi when the country experienced widespread, devastating floods. Beyond our humanitarian assistance, the United States provides approximately $25 million per year under President Obama's Feed the Future and climate change initiatives that are building resilience among vulnerable households in central and southern Malawi. U.S. Ambassador to Malawi, Virginia Palmer, stressed that it is important to tackle agricultural shortfalls holistically. The United States, she said, is committed to Malawi's welfare and development, and we are proud to partner with the people of Malawi in this time of need.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.